Dr. John Patrick has been involved in the medical community for over 50 years. He has incredible wisdom and insight into the realms of public policy and medical ethics, and I am pleased to be joined by him today for a really interesting bonus episode with a ton of different content. Stay tuned. Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Pro-Life Guys podcast, a show dedicated to equipping you with the tools that you need to have compassionate and compelling conversations about abortion so that together we can change minds, save lives, and transform our culture. My name is Cam. I am the host of the show, and I have a really cool bonus episode to talk with you about today. Dr. John Patrick is my guest today. He is an incredibly interesting and experienced fella. He's been involved in the medical community for over 50 years. He has a ton of insight and knowledge in the realm of public policy and Christian morals and ethics. And he has an incredible backstory of being involved and even at times having performed abortions as a very young man, and kind of his conversion to the Christian faith and how that has shaped his worldview and shaped the way that he now employs his wisdom, his experience, his knowledge. I had a really, really great experience talking with him. His grandson joined us on our Florida Abortion Awareness Project mission trip earlier this year in February, which is how we got connected. And been really trying to figure out the best spot for this episode because it is so fascinating, but in many ways very different from our conventional episodes. And so we're featuring it here as a bonus episode, and I hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. All right, Dr. Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time to join the Pro-Life Guys podcast. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I think, of course, at my age, it's always an act of faith. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I'm so glad that you had the opportunity to join us here. And I'm really excited to dive into this kind of exploration as to how we encounter the world around us, how we equip the people that we engage with better tools to develop their logical approach to the decisions that they're making, what we're handing down to our children, our grandchildren, and that sort of thing. But I wanted to start by asking, how does a man become involved in the world of academia and the world of logic and equipping Christians and others with these tools? Was this something that was a passion of yours from a young age? Was this something that kind of came on later in life? Walk me through a little bit of your journey into the role in which you find yourself.
A little bit of the journey. The journey is beyond belief, actually. I've had an incredibly interesting life. Because I grew up in a blue-collar environment in Birmingham where the Industrial Revolution started. No one in my family had ever been to university. All my grandparents on both, grandfathers on both sides and my uncles were all sort of toolmakers, that kind, top end of the working class, which was totally destroyed by the computer-assisted design, which put them out of business overnight, and they were treated with total disrespect. So to that degree, I was impressed that Trump understood blue-collar alienation. And you never hear anti-Trump people or Trump people really talking about the question of blue-collar alienation, the way they've been depressed, demoralized, and alienated over my lifetime. But it happened that, it's a long story to fill in, but by a series of acts of grace, I ended up going to one of the best six schools in England for my high school, the same school that Tolkien had gone to a generation before me. And this was in the 1950s. And at that point, about 3% of the population went to university, which in my view is about the right number. We have far too many people going off to university, and the university is holding its nose and taking their money for no benefit to them. Christians in particular shouldn't fall for that. If you're going to go to university, you should end up with a PhD. If you're not going to do that, don't bother going to university. You're better off learning how to do something well. But that's not a view that everybody will immediately come to. But that's been my view. So I didn't realize what was happening to me. I mean, as a kid going to high school, I'd never been in the company of other kids, all of whom were smarter than me. I'd been top of the class through ordinary elementary school. I never did any work. I just listened and I could remember it all. But that school was better than university. I mean, 99% of the kids went to university, and the 1% who didn't went to Sandhurst or Dartmouth or into the family company. They were all wealthy, except for two boys. Every year there were two affirmative action boys, but not done on a stupid thing of identity politics. The socialist government of Birmingham said, look, we put money into this school and we appreciate what you do. We're very proud of what you do, but we would like you to take two working class boys. And we suggest they can't take your entrance exam because they had French and Latin in the entrance exam aged 11. And that was a very clever way of keeping all the hoi polloi out, because there was no working class kid who could do that. So they said, but we do an IQ test on all the kids in Birmingham every year at 11. So why don't we give you the names of the top 10 and you can take a couple. So that's how I got in. And I loved it. I mean, I got to my homeroom, and my homeroom master in Canadian terms spoke five languages. And his introduction to education at King Edward's as well. You will be learning at least three languages, and you will learn to write a précis in each of them. Thought that's a likely outcome. But of course, they knew what they were doing. It was a real education, the like of which I don't know anybody who's getting. Even those schools are being got at slowly by the wokeification thing. Mark Steyn, who gets himself into trouble pretty frequently, he also was at that school shortly after me. So they train you well. And so I liked nature. I liked biology. I thought about being a vet, then realized it was pure economics. And Birmingham Medical School would take all – they didn't even bother to interview the class. They said, we know that most of you are not going to come, but we'll take you if you want to. I ended up going to London, which was wonderful. Because in my first Sunday in London, a student took me to hear Martin Lloyd-Jones, who I think is the greatest Protestant preacher of the 20th century. And within a month, I also went to hear John Stott. So my choice on Sundays was two of the world's greatest preachers. I can still remember some of their sermons almost verbatim, but they got to my head and not my heart. I believe the story was true. There was no question about that. And I had a mind that likes to understand. So these were just wonderful. But as I said, mind, not heart. And it turned out the only thing I was fit to be was an academic. If the job of professor didn't exist, I wouldn't have been employable. So I never left the academic world, except for a year off in Central Africa, and then thereafter summers in Central Africa. So I got married. We weren't going to have kids. We were careless. Shortly, we had three. My wife said, look, I need more help at home now. Can't you do something different? So I actually did a PhD in order to see my children, which is an unusual reason. And it worked out well. And Sally, again, was the motivation for the next step, saying, well, I like it when you come home at a reasonable hour more often. Can't you do something useful with the results of your PhD? And so I went in a nice warm place. So I went looking, and I discovered that severely malnourished children had a problem that nobody else in the world could look at, because I'd invented a new technique with my colleague Philip Hilton. So I went to the Wellcome Trust, who are wonderful employers, and they said, yeah, that's a good project, we'll pay. Now, when they take you on, you don't have to write a grant. Most professors spend 30% of their year writing grants. I said I could afford 2 years. We went for seven. So for 7 years, I was mollycoddled. I mean, I did not have to write anything significant. All they wanted was one letter a year saying what I'd done in the previous year, what I would do in the next, how much it would cost. And their evaluation was brilliant, not bureaucratic evaluation. They sent 3 world-class scientists to Jamaica every January. Not difficult to get them to go to Jamaica in January, because there were 3 of us with these personal grants. And they were the ones who persuaded us to stay on. They said to the Wellcome Trust, they said, if you keep these 3 guys together, they will finish the job, but it will take 5 years. And the trust said, fine, that's what we're in for that. So we did finish it. I mean, our stock in trade was 10-pound two-year-olds, if you can imagine that. You got kids? Imagine your children at birth weight at 2 years of age. That's, if they weren't that bad, we didn't take them in. And when the unit started after the Second World War to try and understand what to do with these kids, the mortality rate was 50%. When I left in 79, the mortality rate was 0. We'd done it and had the privilege of writing the protocols for all time. We're still to get them into mission hospitals. And we've only got into an American medical textbook in the last couple of years. So these things do not translate into practice quickly. So when that was over, I was supposed to go back to a job in London. Mrs. Thatcher cancelled it. So I came across the Atlantic because I had an offer in Harvard and another one in Ottawa. And Harvard is very uncivilized. It took me less than 24 hours to realize I couldn't work there. They are so petty. And there's no collegiality, no trust. And Ottawa's been wonderful for us. A lovely place to bring up kids. When we arrived in 1980, it was like going back into the 1950s. Girls could walk the streets from the university at night with nobody bothered. There were no murders in Ottawa except in one little bit where the drugs happened. But there were no churches like what we were used to. So we went to the nearest one that believed the gospel was true. I often describe it as one of the most loving and the most ignorant churches I'd ever been in. But they believed the Bible was true. But I didn't show up as a Christian in the university. But I hate the education system that we've got at the moment. If I had my own way, I'd blow up the Faculty of Education and start again from scratch, because they have ruined it. And they require medical students to do a course in biochemistry in 6 weeks. It's nonsense. You can't do that. It's only some abstract educationalist in some faraway place would even presume to suggest that. So I would say to the students, you've got to be cynical about this. Go and look at the previous exams and learn the answers. I'll try and make this as painless as possible. You won't remember any of it. And that's true. You might possibly remember the Krebs cycle, but you'll never meet a patient who doesn't have a Krebs cycle. No Krebs cycle, you're dead. The bits that matter in medicine are small print. So the kids would sit in, some of them, the smarter ones, tended to sit in the front row, not for the biochemistry, but for the throwaway lines. And then one of them heard me give a lecture in Ottawa at the behest of John Bowen, who was the local IVCF organizer, on why the probability of coming out of medical school with your faith intact is only about 10%. It's worse than the university as a whole. You do come back, but it's in your 30s and 40s. That's why we have that hole in the church, that age group. They're recovering from university, and it's going to be longer, and they may not recover. So in the audience, unbeknown to me, was a young man who got into our medical school. And come September, he rather timorously knocked on my door and asked whether I was a Christian. And I said, well, it's a reasonable question, but I do believe the story is true, and I acknowledge there's not much evidence of it in the university. You have to come to my home. I live for my work. And he said, well, I heard that lecture, and there are 4 of us in first year who don't want to lose our faith. Will you help us? And my mother turned up at the back of my head saying, you could do that, you ought to do that. So I said, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, could you do some Bible studies to integrate faith and practice? And I knew I could. And I said, well, you better come to my home at 8 o'clock on, I can't remember, this Wednesday or Thursday evening, and I'll do 4 weeks. I ended up doing 10 years. Once you allow students into your home, of course, you get to like them, and then they have power over you. And at about the same time, I came across four lines from the 12th century, which every Christian kid going to university should know, but they don't. They're this: some seek knowledge for the sake of knowledge, that is curiosity. Others seek knowledge in order that they themselves may be known, that is vanity. Others seek knowledge in order to sell it, that is dishonorable. And some seek knowledge in order to edify others, and that is love. I'd done the first three. I was not guilty of the fourth. And that had to change, I realized. And with my wife's help, that happened. And it was a very important change. And then shortly after that, missionaries came to our church. Sally brought them home for lunch, discovered what I knew, and said, well, you have to come and help us. We have a huge problem with malnutrition, and we don't know how to treat it. I asked them how big. I said, it's not that big. But another, I can't fill in that story because it took about 10 obstacles that I put in the way, but we went. And so all my kids as teenagers spent their summers thereafter working for me in Africa, resuscitating malnourished children. So they all met death in children, held children in their arms that were going to die, but they saved many more, didn't do them any harm. And the oldest one ended up as a missionary in Malawi. The others are all in Ottawa, amazingly. So, the medical students asked to come, and I took them, and I didn't take Christians particularly, because Christians in university, obviously, often they're just a bit of a pain, because they're not related to reality very well. So I wanted idealists. So we took about 40 over the years, and only six of them were Christian, but 17 were when we got back. But that was not my doing. That was the Africans, because I dumped them in a village, 2 days' walk from anywhere, and left them there. And they had to do a health survey of the village. And I checked up once during the 5 weeks that they were surviving. And some of them couldn't wait to get home. Some of them couldn't wait to get back. But all of them said, wow, that has changed me. And more often than not, after those programs got underway, the valedictorian was somebody who'd been to Africa with me at the end of the year. If I had a project and the money to do it, I would take every 15-year-old who's in trouble and dump them in an African village for 5 weeks. They'd come back different. We send our troubled grandchildren, when they're there, we send them off to Malawi because Jana and David are there, and they come back different. It's an immersion reality. Now, at about that time, of course, as the students got to work on me, I wrote an angry paper one day because the Faculty of Education sent a missive saying that all teaching should be from a morally neutral position. And I hit the roof. I was so angry, steam was rising. So I shut my office door, turned off the telephone, and I wrote. And in 3 hours, I'd written a paper called The Myth of Moral Neutrality. And I felt better. I sent it to a friend who was the editor of the Focus magazine for CMDS, and he published it without my permission. And I said, Bob, it was to read, not to publish. He said, have passion. The guys will like it. Well, that little paper went around the world, amazingly. The average paper you read in the you publish in the mainline literature is read by six people, including the referees. It's not about knowledge. It's about careers, as the Claudine Gay episode has demonstrated. And we need to change that. So most importantly, I got a call from the States and was asked to go and talk about what I'd been saying, because they'd just got a new director who'd been in Africa for 10, 15 years and turned a one-man mission hospital into the best teaching hospital in Kenya, an incredibly entrepreneurial guy. But he came back to States in, what would this be, late 80s, early 90s, somewhere around there. And he realized, because he was smart, that evangelical doctors were sailing towards choppy waters and they were not prepared. they knew how to answer all the questions they'd never be asked, and not the ones they would. So they couldn't deal with moral neutrality. They couldn't deal with abortion. They couldn't deal with euthanasia. They didn't know how to talk about sex, marriage, and all those things. Anyway, and particularly if you're a male doctor, fathering. So David Stevens asked me to go and record it. Somehow he got out of a recording of The Myth of Moral Neutrality. It was a bad recording. I didn't know I'd made it. And it was obviously amateur. And he said, I need a better one. So I went and recorded 4 talks. And within a year, I was doing 100 talks a year. And it peaked at about 400 a year, where I stayed for quite a long while. So I did 2 things. I had a deal with the dean that I would give up 1 day a week. I wouldn't apply for any further promotions because I didn't want the administration anyway. And I'd spend at least 2 months a year in Africa and 1 day a week extra to the weekend where I could go off to do weekend trips. And that has changed my life completely. It led to the formation of Augustine College, which is an attempt to teach Christian children where they come from. Yeah. I mean, let me just try it on you. What do these men have in common? Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Boyle, Faraday, Clark Maxwell, Eddington. They're all physicists, I'll give you that.
Yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind, yeah. I mean, presumably they were all Christian, I believe. Yeah, I don't recognize the last couple names, but...
three of them are very evangelical.
Okay.
We don't know that. That is a failure of education of an order that's utterly incomprehensible.
Yeah.
This is the biography of one of them in 90 seconds. Born to a very poor family, father blacksmith, only education in the church, working as a bookbinder by the age of 11 or 12, binding a lot of science, went to the free lectures in London on science, took excellent notes. In a year or two, he didn't want to spend his life being a bookbinder. And he thought he might possibly get a job as a technician at the Royal Institute. So he bound his beautiful notes and sent them to the boss, who was impressed he got the job. He became, in due course, president of the Royal Institute, having never gone to high school, let alone never going to university. Mm-hmm. He was known to stop his committee meetings so that he could get to his prayer meeting. Who is he?
Mm.
He's one of them, so you've got a 1 in 6 or 7 possibility of getting it right. But you don't know, that's the point.
No, I don't, yeah.
It's Michael Faraday.
Hmm.
Who invented the idea of fields.
Yeah.
They laughed at Mr. Faraday's fields when he first proposed them.
Mm-hmm.
And every Christian kid should know that story.
Yeah. And I guess... I mean, there's a million different questions that I would love to go, and I appreciate, thank you so much for sharing that journey, because I think that really cracks open the door to how do we go about making this change? How do we go about as parents, as members of different church congregations and whatnot? And within our professions, absolutely as well. How do we change the way that we learn and use information? As you mentioned, I love those 4 different ways that we can use knowledge. What are the steps towards changing our approach so that we can have a hunger for knowledge, but not for our own benefit, but for the benefit of others? Where do we start when it comes to changing the way that our children and those within our sphere of influence, maybe it's people that are older than us. Maybe when I'm looking at the neighbors around and members of my church who may be far older and far more experienced in different ways, how can I be a part of cultivating a transformation in how we engage with the information around us, with our faith, and how that opens an entire new world? What are your thoughts on how we change that?
Here's the question. When there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, what happened?
Slavery.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't know our own history anymore.
Okay. Yes.
So it starts with history.
Yeah.
We have become so obsessed with our feelings. There's nothing in the New Testament that makes you responsible for your feelings, because you're not. You're responsible for what you do with your feelings, but that's an act of thought, not an act of feeling. But for most evangelicals, they think of their religion in feeling terms. Now, obviously, when Christ comes into your life or God comes into your life, emotion is involved. Feeling is involved. But that's not what it's about. You can actually say this. I love, when I'm preaching, misquoting the scriptures to see if anyone notices. And in an Anglican church, I even get away with this. Paul writes his long epistles because the church was screwing up in different ways. So the Corinthians were out of control sexually. The Romans need to get it organized. The Thessalonians needed to realize the second coming didn't mean you don't need to work. And in each case, he thought the problem could be solved by better theology. So you get a bunch of theology, therefore, and some very simple ethics. I mean, biblical ethics won't fill one page. Love your wife, love your husband, love your children, pay your servants. That's it. So I say, he says something like this: if you followed my argument, then you ought not to be like the people around you. You need to be transformed by the renewal of your feelings. But of course, he doesn't say that. That's precisely the point. It's the renewal of your mind in every case. And he's not interested in the event of conversion so much as the day-to-day salvation. I have heard that your salvation is creating love. Now I am really praying for you. In other words, we have reduced the gospel to something we can manage, and the gospel is not manageable. So reductionism is the biggest problem we face, and I would guess that even your colleagues would have a little difficulty giving an account of how reductionism came to be and why it's bad for us. So out of this, a group of us got together in Ottawa U, six of us or so. We didn't know God had put a very interesting group of profs together. I mean, David Jeffrey was one of the, I consider, the best evangelical intellect in North America. Then Graham Hunter, a world-class philosopher. We had John Paul II's canon lawyer, an expert on Dante. I was the only idiot in the group, but also the only scientist. All the others spoke five languages. I didn't. But we'd all seen young people come from good Christian homes, and I usually say to get under their parents' skin, expect them to lose their mind, their faith, and their virginity in random order in the first year if they haven't done it before they get there. That's our world. And we didn't know what to do about it. So we saw it happen. We started reading together, and we read for seven or eight years, every once a week for a couple of hours, everything we could find on the nature of education from the Greeks to Alistair MacIntyre in the 20th century, and we knew what was needed. What's needed for every kid is an introduction to their own cultural history. It's all about culture. It's not race, it's culture. You can't talk about race without being racist. That should be enough to teach you that that isn't the way to go. You talk about culture. It's culture that makes a difference. And there are only half a dozen big cultures in the history of the world. The rest you can write off. So we started a cultural history course. And we called it Augustine College because of Augustine's motto is, I believe in order to understand. You even find people in church thinking you understand in order to believe. Jesus says to Nicodemus, you can't get to the point of belief from where you are now. Until God touches you, you cannot comprehend. So we started teaching that in 1997. We've been going 25 years. Now, we've only averaged 12 and a half students a year, which is actually a pleasant number, but we need more to make it viable because the guys who founded it could teach for nothing. But we're going to need some salaries. But the good news is that at least 70 to 80% of the kids who take that course hold on to their faith. That's an incredible figure. We ought to have parents and kids queuing up, but it's intimidating to them, I gather. that they look at what we do and say, I can't do that. But they can. They've been dumbed down. And instead of it being told, God has given you a mind that you just haven't exercised. It's like a fat kid saying, I can't lift weights. No, but you can start. And you can lift weights. The time will come. But we haven't been exercising the mind in church forever. You go to sleep on Sunday morning unless you brought a book to read in many churches. And so one of the things that's come out of this, and when the Americans started inviting me all over the place, we run a summer program at Augustine as well for docs, in which we take the 8-month program and spread it out over 8 years and give it a medical twist so that it gets CME credits. And we have an incredible recidivism rate. They come back time and time again. We've got one guy who has been every summer for a week for 25 years. And it's like homecoming, because doctors will walk on eggshells these days with all the woke nonsense going on. So when they come for the week with us, they know they can let it all hang out, talk to one another, pray with one another, and they get educated as well. They love us, and they are the major financial support for the college. We didn't know that that's what's going to happen, because they asked me they loved what we did with their kids and said, what are you going to do for me? And my first response was, well, I've written you off as irredeemable, but you have one thing I need, your money, what would you pay? And we came up with this program.
Yeah.
And they love it.
And so maybe let's build towards more into that Augustine College and the entry point there, and how those 10 years of Bible study with those students that you initially, yeah, this was whether it was a step outside of your comfort zone or whatever you would characterize it as, how that experience working with those students, as you mentioned, inviting them into your home together with the book study with those academics, yeah, really drew together this idea of the Augustine College, and yeah, and maybe speak a little bit more to both of those experiences, the Bible study with the students and, yeah, the book study with the academics, and how those shaped what Augustine College now is.
Yeah, it's very apposite to the whole question of whether you have a pro-life society or a pro-choice one. So the Bible studies, the sad part was, even though they were Christian kids, I didn't need to do any preparation, because no one had taught them to read. That comes as a shock to them, but students coming to university don't know how to read, because we've long since forgotten to teach people how to do that. So when I say to them, look, you read the words, I don't. So if I'm preaching, I always say to the pastor, I want to read the passage myself that I'm going to use. I have your normal reading, but I want to read it myself. Now, it's usual rather than rare that somebody will say something like, I understood more about that passage when you read it than I'd ever understood before you said anything about it. And that's because we were taught to read. We had to read aloud all the way through high school. Masters who cared about the English language. So a conductor doesn't conduct the music. I mean, we wave our hands in time to the music. That's not conducting. A conductor is drawing out the timbre that he wants. I mean, you can listen to a Beethoven symphony and say, Klemperer's conducting that one. He leaves his mark on it. And when a great reader reads a passage, it comes to life. So I always give as my first exercise in my class, write me a precis of Ephesians 1 and 2. And I tell them how to write a precis. And when they, because first of all, I ask them, can any of you stand up and tell me the argument of Ephesians 1 and 2? Of course, I've never had one who could. But they all can after that exercise. And they say, I didn't know you could do that with literature. I choose Ephesians 1 and 2 because Paul's on a rhetorical high. So Ephesians 1 is full of rhetoric and he's over the top. So you need to be able to pull out you love the superstructure, but what's the foundation? And the moment you look at it properly and you compare a few versions, you find the older versions, which cared about style more than we do now. For the praise of his glory occurs three times in the first part of Ephesians, in the first chapter. Before he made us for the praise of his glory. We are to live for the praise of his glory, and we are to celebrate forever the praise of his glory, not because he needs praise, but because he wants to draw us into a life of praise of which we are part. And then there's that marvelous "but God," and the bit all the evangelicals know but can't put into context. I used to teach my whole final year honors biochemistry course entirely on writing praises, because they couldn't read the literature. So I've even had the wonderful experience on one occasion of flying across the Atlantic to do a pro-life talk for the Catholics in London. And halfway across, a young woman walks down the corridor and hesitates at my seat. I was sitting in an aisle seat. When she came back, she stopped and she said, "You're Professor Patrick, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "Sadly, no." And she laughed. She said, "I'm a professor myself now, but it's lovely to see you. Your course is the only one in the University of Ottawa science faculty that taught me to think. And I use your methods now. You took at least a year off my PhD time. And I teach students how to read the literature. And they love it. Evidence-based medicine is rubbish. You've got to ask, until you've defined what you mean by evidence. Now, when you have a politician saying they know what the evidence is, you know they don't. And you get COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. And so from there, I'd love to hone in then towards, as you alluded to just now, the conversation or the, I don't even know if conversation is quite the right word, the interaction as it comes to the abortion issue, and how obviously so often the abortion worldview is formed based off of feelings, experience, and not an awful lot of knowledge or understanding or wisdom or reflection. And I'm curious, as both one with your vantage point, but also having worked with so many students that have come through the Augustine College and others, where do you see the breakdown right now in culture when it comes to this insane culture of death, and how blithely so many approach the abortion question and they don't even see it as a question anymore? We're arguably three, if not four, generations into an abortion accepting culture.
Which is where
die. Is the interaction right now? Exactly. Yes.
So I didn't talk about abortion because I grew up in Plymouth Brethren Church, where I learned the scriptures, but never heard any discussion of anything about application at the level of politics. So I didn't know how to join the conversation in many ways. I even facilitated abortions when I was doing infectious diseases, and women turned up with a rash, turned out to be rubella, and you had to tell them they had a 90% probability of a severely damaged child, both neurologically and cardiac. We were taught, don't mention the word abortion because it was illegal. Just say, "This pregnancy's gone wrong, hasn't it?" And they would say, "Yes." And you say, "Would you like to start again?" "Yes." "Well, we can make that happen. You'll have to come into hospital briefly." And of course it was an abortion, but it wasn't, it was labeled a D&C. It was illegal, but we knew nothing was going to happen. And I didn't feel bad because I'd solved the problem and the woman could have an easier life. I hadn't thought about it at all and didn't think about it for 20 years. And then when the students started pulling me out and I started thinking, okay, then we started teaching ethics in the modern bioethics nonsense, you know, totally incoherent. I mean, the bioethicists are basically lapdogs of power now. That's all they are. It's horrendous. And they've got a lot to be ashamed of. I was never asked to do that because at least I could see clearly what the issues were. So I gave one lecture in the ethics course and the students followed me out. They didn't go to the next lecture. They wanted to talk to me. And I never got another invitation. And they didn't know how to handle me, so they just left me on one side. So when I started being pulled out of my ivory tower, Sally did all the organizing. The way it worked was she had veto powers on what I would do. And people started to complain that they needed to know where I was traveling because they would have come to a lecture. Because they don't think a lot of driving 100 miles to go to a lecture, the Americans. So she put my calendar up and I laughed. I said, well, nobody will go to a website for me. But I was wrong and she was right. And almost immediately, I was going to Ann Arbor and the students from Wayne State called and said, we see you're going to Ann Arbor. You have to go through Detroit. Will you speak to us first? And I said, if you'll drive me to Ann Arbor afterwards, yes. What do you want me to do? And they said, it will be January the 23rd. Yeah, Roe v. Wade. We want you to talk about abortion in the medical school in the middle of the day in Wayne State, which is dominantly black students. You want a place not to do it? I said, I don't want to do that. And they said, we've heard you speak. We think you can. And I said, flattery will get you nowhere. But then they said, we've been praying about it. And I knew, because a few months before, abortion had started to bother me. And one day, one afternoon, I had gone into my office, shut the door, and sat down and said, we're not doing this right. And I wrote out another way to do it over about 3 hours. Then I actually called Robert Spitzer, who's a Jesuit I know well enough to call, and said, Robert, I want you to take this apart because I don't want to get into this can of worms, but this is how I think it should be done. And he listened very carefully and he said, that's good. That will work. You've got to do it. I said, that wasn't what I wanted to hear. And fundamentally, what I do is we don't open it up the right way. So I open it up by talking about diminishing trust, because that's the biggest cultural problem around us. The number of close friends that your generation has is less than mine, and mine is less than the one before. And it's typical now that you get people with no real friends at all. So trust is going down like this. And I knew that. So I can say to them, who do you trust? Now, when I started, they would say, well, a little bit over 50%. Then it dropped to 50%. Now I've been at least two medical schools where a student said, I don't trust anyone yet. Now, you can't practice medicine without a network of trust. Because if you're going to be comfortable to refer patients, you must know the person you're referring to is going to be a competent physician. So it's a serious problem. And the meltdown in 2008 was a failure of trust. Both Wall Street and the government were trained by Chicago, and they were more loyal to one another than they were to truth. And Robert Fogel, who taught at Chicago, I had the privilege of meeting a little before this, had seen it coming, and he wrote a book called The Fourth Great Awakening, which you might find interesting. And it's all about the decline in trust. He says that's going to be the biggest problem of the 21st century. And if we don't fix it, we're dead. So so you can talk to them and they acknowledge there's a problem there. And I said, I presume the ones you don't trust aren't at this lecture. And they nod. And I said, now the rest of you, on the issue of abortion, is there any possibility of agreement in your class? No. That's interesting, isn't it? So I say, how do we sort that out? You respect those people in all other issues, don't you? You respect one another. You think you'll be decent doctors, right? So we've got to find some basis for this difference. And I think you have to ask the question, what would it be necessary to believe to be pro-choice? And what would it be necessary to believe to be pro-life? Now, I think the pro-choice side came by default because as libertarian sexuality came along, unwanted pregnancies were going to be more frequent. And when it was illegal that meant a backstreet abortion. And that's exceedingly dangerous. That shouldn't happen. No one should ever die that way, especially if they're being logical for their own belief system. We know they are overstating the case, but that's a whole other story. If you've never read Nathanson's The Hand of God, read it. It's absolutely gold. It's on your shelf, I can see. Good. It should be, yeah. So then I lay out the nastiness of dying of septicemia from a backstreet abortion. And I say anybody who's seen one never wants to see another. And no society can feel good about itself if young women die that way because they're doing something which we allowed them to do in the first place. We have a responsibility. So I want abortions, because they're being done, I want them to be done properly. They're going to be done, but I want much better evaluation of the people doing them and much require much higher standards. But what they haven't thought about is themselves, what's going on. And I say, before I move to the next bit, I want you to think about the definition of bigot, because it's a word that happens quite frequently. And I think the best one is Chesterton's. A bigot is someone who will not conceive that the opinion that's opposed to their own may be valid. So on this issue, it is the person who uses the word bigot who is the bigot. So I hope the one thing I could contribute to this medical school is that you don't use the word bigot. It's not acceptable. And they nod. And then I say, now let's look at the other side, because you haven't thought about that. And what they haven't thought about is the consequences of abortion. They see what they want and they've got it and they don't want to talk about anything else. Now, it'll take another hour to go through them all, but just quickly, the first thing they have to deal with is the question of what is this creature that we're killing? Yeah, and yet you are killing it. You wouldn't be, if it wasn't alive, you wouldn't have a problem. So you are killing it. So use the proper words. Don't run away from them. And they'll be with me at this stage. And the only way is to say, you can't say it's not alive. And the leading feminists will give you that immediately. They got out of that via a woman called Annette Beyer, who said, look, we must give the thoughtful people on the other side. They will win if we say it's not a living creature, because it is a living creature. And we know that the only place you get a unique DNA mixture is at conception. We must bring the whole conversation to human personhood. So personhood was the clever move. It's not valid, but it's clever. And there are multiple definitions. And the commonest one is probably you become a person when you're capable of relationship. And then that, of course, allows the slide from 12 weeks all the way to partial birth abortion. And of course, if you get a child with an IQ of 80, it won't relate. Infanticide follows. Then you get serious diseases of the brain at any time. That follows. Then you get geriatricide. Anybody who says there isn't a slippery slope simply hasn't looked at the data. There is. But this time, it's getting to be intense, but it's not intense in a bad way. They just haven't thought about this, and I've only just begun. Then I say the next bit is even worse, and you're all suffering from it, because your mother could have aborted you with no risk to herself. But she kept you because she had some hope for what you were going to be. Have you lived up to those hopes? Well, not entirely. You have to earn your personhood, and you can lose it. So we have ramped up anxiety. It's at impossible levels, and everything we do makes it worse because we haven't thought about where it's coming from. So, and then I can even show that the animal rights movement is part of this. And that bit's wonderful because the first time I did it was in Harvard, of all places. And you have this argument with yourself as you're going through. And I mean, if you want an adrenaline rush talking about a pro-life position in a place like Harvard, that'll give you an adrenaline rush. But a poem by Robert Frost popped into my head at exactly the right moment, and it was wonderful. It worked beautifully. But you go on down the system. It's not finished. Once you go down this process, here's the sequence I normally take. Extrinsic rights replace intrinsic rights. You have to earn your personhood. You become an uncertain self. You buy into animal rights. The worst one is altered justice. The one dissenting judge in the Roe v. Wade decision said, this is raw judicial power. And the best argument, and you should have it. Have you read Arthur Leff on justice and democracy? It's a paper. No, it's not a book. It's not a book. It's a paper. Just put Justice Leff, Duke Law Review, 1979, and read the article. He's not a believer. It's brilliant. Every lawyer should have a copy on his phone. That's how good it is. It opens like this. I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete immanent and transcendent set of propositions about right and wrong, findable rules that direct us as to how to live our lives righteously. He's Jewish. What he wants is the law from God, transcendent, immanent, accessible to us. But he goes on, but I also want to believe, and so do you, in no such thing, but rather that we are wholly free to decide for ourselves what we ought to do and what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is to be simultaneously perfectly ruled and perfectly free. That is, at the same time, to discover the right and the good and to invent it. You can't have both. And he knows that. And he writes 20 pages of lucid prose. And at the end, he can't live with himself. So he comes down on the politically correct side and then writes one final paragraph saying, I don't believe a word of that conclusion. But he can't say it properly. It's wonderful. And it comes straight out of the abortion movement. With this, of course, you cannot do these sorts of things and not lose compassion. So if you're doing abortion, you're not going to be as compassionate as you were before. We need, on grounds of justice and democracy, to demand that a mother who's pro-life can have a pro-life obstetrician and pro-life medicals. We need to divide the medical system, create competition within a single funder on the basis of ethics. And we've got plenty of data coming out of the state showing that it works. Because we cost on average 25% of what unbelievers do in lifetime healthcare costs. We ought at least to be getting a tax deduction, and we're not. And you've never heard a minister of health saying, go to church, it'll lower our costs. It would, because somebody will notice if you drink too much or whatever, you know. And we're not pushing the practicalities, we should. The next thing it destroys is the loss of meaning and suffering, and that is an important one. And the bit of me that turns up on YouTube most is a description of the young man with CF who turned my life around in a way, made me address a problem. He said, it says in the Bible, if you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. I'm 19 and I'm dying. I don't want to. What do you say? And with some help from on high, I was able to help him through that, and he died very well. But I hadn't done that for 20 years. So I had to change. And it's all related. And finally, of course, we no longer have a common good. In other words, we're eroding the foundations and expecting this nice building to be unaffected by that. It's not. It's going to fall apart. So the last line is always the same. I've laid out two worlds for you. Which world do you want to give to your children? Lots of people are using it now. It's available in various places. I have a website, I have a podcast, and the best collection of my talks is the Americans, because they stick microphones on you and they've been doing it for years. So if you go to CMDA US and put my name in, you'll get dozens of talks.
That is excellent. And that's unfortunately where I wanted to start wrapping together on. I could speak with you all morning here. But how do people learn more, and how do people learn more about the Augustine College, and where
Augustine
people...
College has a website? Yes. AugustineCollege.org. Yeah. I have a website, johnpatrick.ca, and I have a podcast, Dr. John Patrick Podcast, will find it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. We'll drop all of those in the show notes before. I feel like I could ask you a million more questions and take up your entire day here.
We need more than anything else is, if you've got a bright kid in your church who's about to go to university, raid the piggy bank and send them to us. We're not expensive, and they will get into second year if they're good. And we'll tell them, don't bother if they're not good enough, and save them all the money. I mean, one of the guys on our board now, when he finished, he said, you gave me a book list that will last me a lifetime, and I knew that I was not academic, so I went and got the bits of paper I needed, and he's now a very successful businessman. He said, I would have wasted 4 years for no advantage. Thank you.
Gotcha. And that was going to be my question of, what can people expect at Augustine College? Is this a four-year program?
It's an eight-month. It's just an eight-month program.
Love it.
We do the history of science, medicine, math, art and architecture, literature and philosophy, the church, music when we can, and literature. Read from the premise that we are the product of Hebrew and Greek thought modified by the church. No other culture has made a major contribution. And the biggest problem, reductionism. If you can't define it, come and learn to define it. I didn't. I was turned into a reductionist in my first year at medical school without the word being used.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. It's not the Enlightenment.
No.
That starts in 1277.
And that, folks, is where we need to start. And I think that's brilliant advice. Whether it's the bright young kid about to go off to university, or like we've talked about through this entire thing, wherever you are at in the audience, this is something that maybe I'm the eternal optimist and whatnot. I don't think anyone's a lost cause. And I would say that regardless of where you're at, whether you are
on this course would be good for anyone.
Exactly. Exactly.
You make friends for life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you will appreciate the difference between people who are meant to be academic and those that aren't, and you won't waste your time.
Yeah.
And particularly if you've got kids who have done a year at university and they hated it, take a break.
Yeah.
Come and do our course, and you may or may not go back afterwards. But if you do go back, it'll be a different situation.
Different.
We had one medical student who was in medical school, and she knew there were all sorts of questions not being answered. She found us on the web. And no dean will refuse a medical student a request to take 8 months out, because medical students are burning out.
Yeah,
and that looks very bad on the dean's transcript, because we've spent too much money on them, and you're not getting them through to being a doctor. You're failing at your job.
Yeah.
So we would help to produce more and better doctors, because they won't burn out at the same rate. Students are what we need more than anything else. And the Jews, of course, make sure that Jewish kids in the synagogue get a good education. Yeah. And the synagogue pays.
Yeah.
We don't even have, in most churches, we don't even have an education fund.
Yeah.
We don't even think about it as something we should be ready and able to help with.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that can be a gut check time as well for each of us in the audience of how do we empower students and young people to access these tools to shape their life in a way that because this could be a whole nother episode or a series of episodes of all of the, whether we want to call them regrets or the number of people that I've spoken to and that speak at churches about how they learned these lessons 10 years before they retired or after their kids had moved out of home. And if we could equip our children with the lessons that we have learned so late, that would be wonderful. Dr. Patrick, I thank you so, so much for all the time that you've already given me. I hope that we can connect again in the future. But blessings on your ministry. And thank you so, so much. All right, folks, there's my conversation with Dr. John Patrick. A ton of wisdom, ton of insight, ton of experience in the realm of medical ethics and practice. public policy and how Christianity ought to be shaping our lives. I hope that you enjoyed the conversation. I certainly did so. And I hope that you appreciate a bonus episode here that is a little bit off the beaten track of what we often cover, apologetics wise per se, but interesting to get insight and reflections from people who are part of the pro-life community. And so thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and may God bless you abundantly wherever you're at, however many hours are left in your day.